Welcome to No More Booze, the podcast. I'm Olivia Farrelly, and in every episode, I explore the role that alcohol has in our lives. I interview people who have decided to live their life with no more booze. We'll explore their relationship with alcohol, how it made their life better, how it made their life worse, any lessons they've learned along the way, and what advice they would give to others who are contemplating a life without alcohol. So whether you are sober curious, you're sober serious, or you're already living your life alcohol-free, this podcast will provide inspiration and motivation as you begin to untangle and reassess your relationship with the booze. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to No More Booze, the podcast. Today, we have another beautiful guest to tell us her fabulous story of being off the booze almost 3 years. It is Angela Carney, who is ringing in from Mayo. So we want all the goss from Mayo over this past week. But you are so welcome, Angela. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you, Olivia. Thanks for having me on. Yes, life is good at the moment, I'm pleased to say.
Excellent. Do you want to give the listeners just a sense of who you are and what brings you here?
Yeah. So, as you said, Olivia, my name is Angela. I live in the west of Ireland. And on this occasion, I'm nearly 3 years sober. And I now work as a hypnotherapist. So I basically help people who themselves are struggling with addiction to get them sober.
Yeah, amazing. And you're in the west of Ireland. It's Mayo, isn't it?
Yes, Westport.
Westport, yeah. So you've had a big week.
And I was... heads around for sure. I think there's a lot of people that aren't allowing the party to stop quite yet. But yeah, it's been very busy. Yeah, but it's been great. Really good energy around.
And I think that's what I went to Mayo. I said it in last week's podcast, but I went to Mayo at the beginning of the week, right? I get awful notions. I'm very impulsive. And I just was very starry eyed. And I said, fuck this. We are heading to Castlebar over to my two besties, right? Who incidentally don't drink either. So the three girls who were mad drinkers back in the 90s and the noughties are like, sober gals, sober baristas now. But anyway, so headed off all, but it was what a week, what energy. It's the energy that we all want a bit of.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I suppose everybody in Mayo has witnessed that, you know, that terrible depression that people would have gone through. You know, like anything in life, you get your hopes up and then they're dashed. But I guess that's resilience for you because, you know, fans never really give up hope. Which it would have been quite easy to do in, you know, many areas of life. That's never going to work or whatever. But I think that belief was always there, much the same as it is, you know, in every aspect of life, how you see something, what you hope for, you know, that in itself was, you know, amazing. So, yeah.
And actually, isn't it such a gorgeous metaphor, and can't we relate it? Oh my God, let's relate it back to alcohol, right? You try and you try and you try and you go to 11 finals and like maybe there's hope, there's resilience, as you said, bounce back ability, like, but everybody, and this is the thing that I tell everybody, you will get there. Right. You mightn't see that you will get there, but you will get there. And isn't it gorgeous? And I suppose then again, of course, this is the gorgeous thing about having a community as well. There's people around you who believe in you, who know. So I would have gone to a lot of those finals, right, with the two besties. And do you know what? All we wanted, we knew what we wanted to feel when it happened, and that's what we were looking for. So I was listening to Peter Crone this week, actually, and he said, it's not that, you know, we don't all want to be millionaires, right? You know, we want the feeling of having no worries when it comes to money, right? We don't want the thing, we want the thing that we feel that we have, that we'll get when we have the thing.
Yeah.
Isn't that it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose, yeah, the other side of that is kind of learning to be okay in the world when things don't go the way that we want them to go, which is very common in people with addictions. It's, you know, life seems to, you know, I would have been one of them. Life would seem to happen to me and that difficulty when things didn't go according to plan. So yeah, the Mayo match is certainly an example of, a lot of times life doesn't go your way. And the same with people who make, many attempts to get sober. There is always hope, always hope.
Always
I've met
hope.
people who have been to up to 12 treatment centers. And I just think that beneath that, the resilience in a person after the 11th time it didn't work for them to still go back on a 12th occasion, that in itself to me is just wow, how resilient. Because it would be so understandable, to see that person if they gave up, if they just decided, look, it's just not going to happen. So yeah, I think resilience, and most people I find that have issues with addiction have, even though a lot of people looking from the outside could see these people have no willpower, they are weak. It's the furthest thing from the truth, because to struggle with an addiction, especially if it's progressed to the stage where it just completely takes over your life, you need an incredible amount of resilience to actually live with that. There's so much involved, the hiding, the lying, the covering your tracks, the getting access to it, the constantly being driven by this need to keep using, whether it's alcohol or drugs or whatever, despite the consequences. And or in that, many attempts to try to stop and to go back and forward, back and forward. Huge amount of resilience. And it is that very resilience that for most people, when they finally stop, that will see them through to long-term recovery, because they have that resilience. It's there, so
Yeah.
yeah.
And I think it, especially with alcohol, it is a little bit different in terms of, if there's any other substance, right, that somebody gets addicted to, like society at large and, the environs of people's lives, the people around them blame the substance. But with alcohol, there's a tendency to blame the person. And I think that's kind of, that's been manufactured of sorts as well, So we have, and I often talk about this. So we're all encouraged ad nauseum and incredibly encouraged to drink alcohol. And then if you develop a dependency, an addiction, whatever is your circumstance around alcohol, then you're blamed. And then
I
people
know.
kind of tend to, move away or, it's
Yeah,
very hard.
it's quite, yeah, it's bizarre, but it's a form, I suppose it's a form of brainwashing. It's on a large kind of, to a large degree, I suppose. And even people that grow up in homes where there is alcoholism, the brainwashing starts very, very early. Drinks companies, they have a reason to push it. Like the images that they show us of what alcohol does is not the reality. It's the beautiful models throwing their heads back, laughing, having a great time. They don't show the 5 a.m. in the morning full of fear and regret and shame. And yeah, I think that is the thing with alcohol, that it's completely acceptable, it's pushed, it's in our culture. It's even people that I work with who are grey area drinkers, one of their biggest fears, actually, when I think about it, it's so strange. It just shows how indoctrinated people become, with the whole thing, that but sometimes their biggest fear is, what will people say when I say I'm not drinking? What will they think? Which is crazy, because there is a truth. I'm a non-drinker myself, and prior to a relapse, I was sober for 16 years. And yeah, I have been in situations where people are uncomfortable if you're in a scenario where there is are people drinking. I mean, I wouldn't announce to a group of people why I don't drink, but yeah, you can feel that, sometimes that discomfort that other people feel around a non-drinker. So yeah, it is. I think if people start to be more aware even of how that brainwashing is so pervasive, it's so insidious, it's everywhere. I mean, even now I notice when I go to the cinema, of course now couple of years ago, you now, can buy wine or beer or whatever at the cinema, and then you're bombarded with a lot of ads before the film even starts. So again, that's a very strong message. It's, every single thing you do in life will be elevated if you use alcohol along with it. And it sends a very strong signal to the subconscious mind, which is what advertising does. It plays on the subconscious mind. It's basically sending a message to the subconscious mind, who you are in your just your natural being is not good enough. It needs more. It can be better. You can be better.
Absolutely. And there was a survey that or research that came out of the at the beginning of the week here, and it was research by a drinks industry representative body, right? So it said that alcohol use has gone down 36% since 2001. So, anybody would think, oh, that's a really good thing because in Ireland we, have a problem with alcohol. Well, the perception is that we have a problem with alcohol, right? That a lot of people do. But, I would celebrate that. Most people would celebrate that. But their reaction to the levels of drinking going down was to lobby the government to reduce taxes by 10% so that alcohol then would be cheaper, which seems wild. But like you said, the conditioning that people go through, the messages, subliminal messages that they're getting from big organizations, big corporate organizations who are focused on profit and profit alone. Once we know what people are doing, once we are aware of what they're doing, we can untangle from that level of conditioning. Plus, giving up alcohol makes us clear. We have clarity in our lives. We realize that every system in the world is flawed and that we have. Then a response. Well, we don't have responsibility, but we can make up our own minds about that and be. I'm not listening to that bullshit. That's a load of shit. Do you know what I mean? Which is the stage that I'm at. But yes, allowing you just need to be very educated, don't you? And
Yeah, I think
empowered.
it's just in general in the world, like have your eyes open. Don't be don't go through life unconscious. Be conscious, be aware. Unfortunately, there are, scenarios, I suppose, out there where we kind of just, go along with things. And as a hypnotherapist, I know that advertising companies, they employ hypnotherapists. They know exactly how to hook you. They show the ad repeatedly because the subconscious mind likes repetition, so it knows it's going to hook you that way. And, it's all kind of sinister in a way. I mean, their aim is obviously to get people to buy their products to make money, off you, and they're not concerned, obviously, about the negative effects of alcohol. Even now, it's been shown that in small amounts, it has a negative impact on people. And I think they really pushed the agenda from the 90s to really market alcohol to women. These marketing agencies began to realize that, oh, there's so many more women out in the workforce now, they have money. So, that's when they started making drinks more, they feminized drinks, like it was pastel labeling, pink labeling, naming it as reduced calories, all of these things, making. And you see even now, like drinks that are mixed in cans, a gin and a tonic in a can, they're slim cans, normally pink or pastel colors. And it was promoted in a way that you are equal to men. You can do what men can do, and it's all about the sisterhood. It's all about female empowerment. You're not just a mother. There you are all day long, slaving away in the home. You deserve a drink. So all of this messaging, kind of became so pervasive and still exists today.
And to be able to, like you said, become conscious of it and remove yourself from that messaging. Know the origin story of it, know where it came from, know what the goals of it are, and to be able to remove yourself from it then as well. And I know, and I've said this before, like I remember when I was going out age 15 and 16, right, to the local disco, right, the Oasis in Carrickmacross, right, we'd get £20 to go out, right? So that was a fiver on the bus, a fiver in, and £10, right? So £10 brought you three drinks. That was it. There was no tap, there was no extra money, there was no nothing. You had three drinks. None of our friends had extra money, so there was no chance to get other drinks, right? So then I started working, and obviously I had more money. So like, and we used to have this like magic 50 that we used to, hand over to each other and then get back and all this kind of stuff. But like, it's mad to think that, when I became financially independent and had access to a lot of money, then my alcohol intake increased as well. So like, that's case in point there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's and it's an addictive substance. If you drink and enough of it, there is a chance you can become addicted to it. And that's a whole other level of hell, in living. And of course that doesn't happen to everybody, but it certainly happens to a large amount of people. And even as you say, like with that survey that people aren't drinking as much, there's still the bigger issue that people there are so many people that but there are still too many people who are and whose
And
lives are really damaged and affected by it,
yeah, and we all know this, and the
Yeah.
conditioning runs so deep that we give alcohol a free pass for so much. But like I was looking through my podcast list for the last kind of let's say 10 podcasts, right? And I have a trigger warning on a lot of them because people talk about how their loved ones take their lives under the influence of alcohol. So like we're giving an it a free pass. We're not allowing it to have responsibility for so many tragedies. We're not talking like so many people who come on the podcast as well talk about growing up in homes where alcoholism was rife and all the trauma that ensued as a result of that. And yet we're still so, like you said, conditioned to think that this is not just like without harm to like society and families and stuff, but not without health harms, which I suppose now is being shown that there's a lot.
Yeah, I think the statistics, I suppose, for alcohol-related deaths in Ireland, that's they're not even really true figures because there are so many other deaths that can be indirectly caused by drinking. Most of the cancers now. Even I was talking to somebody the other day who's someone belonging to them had it was an alcoholic and got cancer. It was a cancer that wasn't one of the more serious ones and could have been, he could have survived it. But because of the fact that he was an alcoholic, there's more of a chance that you're not going to be going for health checks or, oh, something feels wrong, so I should go and get that checked out. It was too late by the time. And even like suicides in relation to alcohol and addiction, I think it's something like nearly 60% of suicides. The toxicology reports would show alcohol, and I think it's up to 80% would show alcohol and drugs. They probably aren't directly, put into those statistics of people who die. But if you think about it, like if you to make a decision like that to take your own life, you don't have a brain anymore that is functioning. In order to make a sound decision, the prefrontal cortex, the part that's responsible for logic, for sound decision making, that's gone offline. So you can even see how a substance like alcohol can, when it affects the brain in that way, when someone gets to that really, really sad stage of deciding that's the only way out, at that stage, their mind isn't sound anymore, and that's the really sad part of it, because I really do believe that
a large percentage of those people that would have taken their own life would not have made that decision if their mind was not addled with alcohol or drugs. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll change gears a little bit now, and what we might talk. Well, that was a lovely conversation. Thank you. I unexpected also. Do you want to explain to us, you know, I suppose, how alcohol was introduced to your life and what it did for you until it didn't do that anymore?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a home, I suppose, to just give a little bit of a background. My father was an alcoholic, a chronic alcoholic. So I suppose looking back on everything now, there would have been conditioning there from, you know, the beginning. So there was a lot of chaos, a lot of unpredictability. So I guess that became the norm for me. But I suppose like for anybody who comes from that kind of a home, I guess when you're out in the world, you probably have a difficulty in fitting in as much as, say, somebody that came from a more secure home. Not always. So I would have drank first maybe when I was about 14. And, you know, I do remember it. It was a feeling of, wow. Yeah, it was kind of like it took away the feeling that I'd had for, you know, a lot of my life, which was I didn't want to crawl out of my own skin. You know, it was an escape. Not an escape from home, but it was an escape in my mind. And I think that was the most powerful part of it. You know, when we know so much now about neurochemicals, what's actually happening in the brain when something like this happens, it's an amazing reward. Your brain reminds you. It's, you know, your reward system reminds you, remember that feeling. So I didn't become an alcoholic overnight. But it certainly had a powerful effect on me. Then I went through my, you know, my late teens, my 20s. You know, my drinking would have been considered somewhat normal, I suppose, because at that stage, everybody was falling in and out of nightclubs. And it was fun. Not all of my drinking was a nightmare. Absolutely not. I had, you know, fantastic times. But I'd say looking back, by the time I was probably in my maybe late 20s, I definitely think then I had started drinking in an unhealthy way. I was beginning to be more secretive about my drinking. I was beginning to drink more after a nightclub at home. So yeah, that continued and kind of really escalated. And in my early 30s, I ended up in my first treatment center. And so on leaving there, I remained sober for 16 years. And you know, I had all the benefits of being sober. It wasn't always easy, but I, you know, managed to build a life for myself. I searched a little bit deeper, you know, into myself, I suppose, and meaning and life and everything else. And during that time, I set up a food business that became very successful. But there was a lot of work involved. Like it was, you know, it was hard going. And I think looking back on it, all the things that have kept me sober for all those 16 years are the very things that I just stopped doing, stopped meditating. I just became focused on the business. That was everything, you know, and just being burnt out and under pressure. And I actually just, it started with, it was kind of my late 40s. I started smoking weed. And, you know, the way that I looked at it was, well, I didn't have a problem with weed. I was in a treatment center for alcoholism. And again, that started off like I would smoke, the odd joint. Again, my messaging to myself was, yeah, I needed to relax. I'm under a lot of pressure. You know, it's completely natural that I would need something. And then within a very short space of time, I was smoking it every day. And I already started to notice how things in my life began to deteriorate, like not replying to emails on time, not addressing stuff that needed to be addressed with staff. I started to, just become a little bit more depressed, a little bit more, life seemed a bit more lackluster. You know, it's like that is addiction, isn't it? When you just, the narrow focus becomes on just the high. And then pretty soon, I started experimenting with other drugs, and really and truly, within probably a year and a half, I was a full-blown drug addict and alcohol. Yeah.
And
someone who had never taken, really done drugs, that was, I guess I told myself, because I never had a problem with drugs, that drugs are, they're fine.
Yeah.
So that then led me down a road of, oh my God, like 4 or 5 years trying to get sober. I went back to another treatment center. I managed to get sober for 7 months and relapsed again. And I suppose my story, it's like I would not have been what most people would have pictured when they would picture a person who was in addiction. And I was severely in addiction, but I had the veneer, I suppose, of, you know, success. You know, most people can consider a rock bottom when you lose everything, or when you, you know, you crash your car, or those kind of things. I mean, I've had many rock bottoms, but I guess because I was self-employed, like I wouldn't have been, you know, I couldn't fire myself, work for anybody else. I would have been fired a long time ago. I could just like ring staff from home on the phone, you know, if they managed to get a hold of me, and, you know, just run my business that way. But of course, that's not an effective way of running a business. And eventually it all fell apart, you know, and I ended up losing everything. And I see, looking back on that now, that that was probably the rock bottom that I needed, because I don't actually know if I had had it in me then to actually stop. I had tried everything.
Yeah. And then, you know, just when you're talking there, and like, answer this if you want, it's quite personal, but you know, you had said that your dad was an alcoholic, and I've read and I've heard, you know, Professor David Nutt talk about, you know, tolerance being inherited, right? And I've very little tolerance. Like, there was times I could have 3 drinks and blackout, right? But then there was other times that I could have 9 drinks and be fine, you know. So there was, I always talk about Russian roulette there. Do you think you'd inherited a tolerance, maybe genetically, or like, had you built it up over the years, or what was your tolerance like for alcohol?
Yeah, I had a very high tolerance.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I wasn't like at the, you know, at the later stages of addiction, I wasn't getting high anymore at all.
Yeah.
I was getting nothing from the drugs. I was getting nothing from the alcohol. I was just purely using to feel normal, and to not go through withdrawals. I think it's probably a mixture of many things in regards to, you know, coming from a home where there, you know, where there's alcoholism. Yeah, you know, nobody had, I think, has a definitive answer. You know, there are many theories, I suppose. Yeah, genetics are one, but the environment, I think, that a person grows up in is a huge factor. There's been so much research done on that now, that even how the brain of a child develops in a house where there is trauma, that their brain, their neurochemicals don't develop in the same way. They don't have those same level of feel-good hormones like dopamine. So the first time a person that maybe comes from a childhood, an adverse, you know, childhood, the first time that they take that drink or drug, it can have a more powerful effect on them, because it's maybe the first time they ever felt connected, that the first time they ever felt that they weren't in some kind of emotional pain. And that is very, very powerful. So it probably was a mixture of all those, of all those things. Also, my father was very vocal about how amazing he thought that alcohol was. So I would have been, to a degree, brainwashed. Like, he had a distrust of people who didn't drink.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be quite vocal in talking about them, that they were sneaky, underhanded people, that they couldn't be trusted. So it kind of was almost like being brought up in a cult where, the God that I was taught to worship was alcohol. And I did, I guess, like, that is what happens in your subconscious mind. Your subconscious mind, up until the age of 7 or 8, is like a sponge. It will believe anything or anyone. You know, if you tell like a 5-year-old child, you know, if you open that door there, there'll be a yellow dragon, that child will believe you. So I suppose me as a child hearing that, that's really, I think, also where addiction begins. And in my experience, and my experience with working with people, is what are the beliefs that you've picked up from an early age? Because certainly before the age of 7, your brain is in what's known as a theta brainwave state, which is the same brainwave state that you're in hypnotherapy, in hypnosis, the same brainwave state that you're in before you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning. It's, you know, kind of an in-between stage, and you're highly suggestible at that age. And I suppose whatever your beliefs are, whatever you have been told about who you are up until that age, often becomes what is known as your blueprint. And underneath most addictions, and most people I deal with in addiction, underneath the addiction, there is a negative self-belief. And that's a lot of the reason why a lot of people drink, because they don't want to think about the thoughts. They don't want to think about the fact that they don't like themselves.
But this is very, very, very subconscious, unconscious programming, isn't it? That, like, people, we're talking, this is under layers and layers and layers. Like, this won't be at the forefront of your mind, you know? This will be a driver within you that you might not have any conscious awareness of at all.
No. You know, when I work with people, that is one of my main aims, is to find out what are their beliefs about themselves.
Yeah.
And that is where I see remarkable results, because when I can guide somebody to figure out where did that belief come, where did that belief, you know, I hear people, you know, they can be the person that's in a crowd and they're, you know, having their drinks and they look like they're the life and soul of the party. They're the very same person that will go home and think, you know, I'm a worthless person. I'm useless. I'm not good enough. I'll never get what I want in life. Where did those beliefs come from? When I often go back and find out, it's often from, it could be a parent, it could be a teacher, it could be the school bully, it can be culture. And once those beliefs are looked at, and that's the important part, it's the tough part too, but, you know, getting sober, it's a lot easier, I think, than people think it is, but it's not plain sailing. But when people look at these beliefs and I help them dismantle them, and I'm helping them dismantle them, not because I'm trying to make them feel better, I'm dismantling them because I can see that they're not true. Because this very same person that I'm dealing with has also given me a huge amount of evidence of what phenomenal people they are that have achieved things. Like, I'm always thinking, wow, really? You did that, did you? That's amazing. You know what I mean? But yet, beneath all of those great achievements, their subconscious programming is that of, you know, I'm really not that great. So once that is changed, it's very hard to change a habit when the belief underneath that habit feels like it's helping them survive. Survive often from the thoughts that they have in their own mind. And when you engage in a behavior over and over again, it becomes automatic. The subconscious mind likes repetition, and it also likes what's familiar. It doesn't like what's unfamiliar. So if you've been drinking and, you know, using alcohol to deal with emotions, which is one of the main reasons, I suppose, for many, many years, the thought of changing that is so terrifying for people, because your subconscious mind thinks you are actually under serious threat. That's why when people are on that precipice of, you know, when they really see their life has fallen apart and the decision to make that choice, so many people will stay there because their subconscious mind is throwing up every single reason and catastrophe that is going to await them around the corner if they stop drinking. Mm-hmm. And it is a big ask, because at that stage, if somebody, you know, if it's like a serious addiction, normally, yeah, it's a big ask to ask somebody, okay, be sober now, and now you're going to have to look at your life. And it's you know, it's not easy. But I guess I think on that precipice, it was something that I heard that for me made a huge amount of sense. It's when the fear of staying the same becomes greater than the fear of change. And to me, that was the crux of it on the day that I made that decision. And I remember it so well. It was, I mean, the fear of getting sober was unbearable. It was the most frightening thing I could even think of. But, and the fear of staying the same trumped it, only by a very small margin. But I only needed that small margin, you know.
And that's so true. And probably I say that a lot, that saying, but I've never actually applied it to my own giving up the booze scenario. And I suppose when I looked at it, the fear of, when I gave up booze, it was in Nerca in Spain in a bed, the fear of being what I thought was the pathetic, ridiculous behavior of a mother of two small kids, right, who was capable and all the rest. Like, it was the thought of having to spend the next 40 years being a lush and what in like being th that's the word that came to point, was pathetic, being pathetic, listening to myself, right? I was like, F this, right? That was so much worse than not having a couple of gins or a glass of rosé on holidays or whatever. You had said, you mentioned just in the beginning there, you had stopped doing the things that kept you sober for those 16 years. Can you give the listeners a sense of, you mentioned meditation, but what were the other things that kept you on track, kept that beautiful mindset going?
The first time around, for sure, meditation was a big one. I also went to therapy to deal with my past as well. I trained as a nutritional therapist around that time, so nutrition became a huge part of my recovery. It's often, again, somewhat overlooked. When I work with clients, I always will ask that question, how are you doing, food-wise, because we really need that serotonin in order to start helping us feel better as quickly as we can, in order to make sobriety easier. And most of our serotonin is produced in our gut, 95% of it. So, again, all of these things. So I've always been someone that's been curious about a lot of things. So yeah, I just researched. I knew all the things that I needed to do. I found on that occasion, I found early sobriety very difficult. I had very strong urges to keep drinking, very strong. The only thing that I do remember is that I kept focusing on how my life had improved, because there's no two ways about that. Nobody can tell me that their life doesn't improve when it's on, even if it's a smaller quantity, or it just improves. So yeah, I did all of the things. Like, I went to India, went to an ashram. I kind of went, down that road, was careful about the people I hung out with. I hung around with great people, always made sure I had good people in my life. Yeah, I think the meditation where that really helped me was that it calmed my mind. It calmed my mind. And I knew that if I had that calmness, I looked at it like, in a, I suppose, in a very honest way. I didn't want to go back. I didn't want to go back, but yet I had very strong urges to go back. But I suppose what I know now, which what I didn't know then, is that I still hadn't addressed my mind. I hadn't challenged my mind in a way that I needed to. I could have maybe got out of those urges a lot easier. I could have made more sense out of them. So yeah, I think by the time I relapsed, I had no program. I had no sober tools at all. And I was very stressed. My world was, very stressful. It had all taken off too much. I think also my limiting beliefs remained. I built this business to be a great success. I never really expected that was going to happen, because I still had a limiting self-belief of that, which was a very common one with me. I wasn't always conscious of it, but I'm much more conscious that I had it now, that which was, yeah, don't expect much from life, because good things don't really happen to people like you. And then when, oh my God, this company really took off, looking back on it now, I realized that I never really felt I deserved it. I never, it felt too alien. Remember, I said the subconscious likes what's familiar. It was too unfamiliar to me to feel that life was going well, life was going my way. I had everything. But my subconscious mind hadn't caught up with that belief. So it almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy to a degree, but I guess to rebuild my life this time around, I think, I have demolished those limiting self-beliefs, and I do it by always being conscious of them. I don't need alcohol to bury them, because if they come up now, and they do pop up at times, they don't overwhelm me. It's not a reason for me to, you know, to drink again. I guess I've trained my mind to a degree to allow it to be okay with a normal life. You know, I grew up in a lot of chaos. Again, some people, why after many years of being sober do they go back? Some people can become very uncomfortable with life actually being good.
Yeah.
And they can confuse that life being calm and good with it being boring. And it's not. It's your nervous system.
Yes.
Feeling uncomfortable with, yeah, I'm not used to this. I'm not used to an ordinary day. Yeah. And that does take getting used to in early recovery. And, you know, and it takes time for the brain to recalibrate, for the nervous system to recalibrate. And sometimes people can confuse those early weeks or early months even with, you know, there's that when your dopamine has been artificially affected so frequently, it begins to downregulate. You need a lot more dopamine in order to get the same result, which means, I suppose, over time, that's what happens, I suppose, in addiction. You need a lot more of the substance, but you get a lot less of the euphoria. You know,
yeah.
And then your
yeah.
world begins to narrow. Things that you once used to enjoy no longer do anything for you. You don't want to hang out with friends. You don't want to go for a walk with your dog. You don't want to hang out with your kids even, you know, at the more progressive stages of addiction. And when people stop, it takes a while for that dopamine system, because your dopamine levels have gone below baseline. It takes them a while to come back again. And people can confuse that time. Everything can feel flat and dull because for so long the only thing that really maybe made you feel alive or had that maybe there was some peace was the alcohol or the substance. After that, everything can seem a little bit gray. It's called anhedonia, flatness, a grayness. And sometimes people confuse that feeling of, well, sobriety is not working for me. This grayness wants to live like this. But sometimes when people understand what it is, this time around, because I educated myself on what was actually happening in my mind, when I went through those flat phases, I didn't automatically think, which I would have done in the past, because on my last attempt at sobriety, I went through years of trying, getting a few weeks, a few months back again, because I would not be able to make it through that gray phase where everything felt flat and nothing, because I felt that I would have seen that as my brain is too damaged, it doesn't work anymore, so this is my life now. I guess for anybody listening to this, if you're there on that precipice trying to make that decision, don't use the way that you feel now in this moment to think in any way that it's going to represent how you're going to feel in a few weeks, a few months. And for people it differs, you know, some people can get that feel good feeling back very quickly. More so with, if it's alcohol, with drugs and alcohol, your dopamine system has been impacted in a lot more severe way. So it can take a little bit longer. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what you say, like the visualization process is a good one. Maybe if you have the ability, and like we've lots of tools now, so you can look at somebody, right? Feel what they're feeling. Like there's so many sober, you know, like hype accounts on Instagram. Look at what they're saying. Imagine yourself in that position. Feel the feelings of that. It might take a bit of effort, and then maybe work your way back. And I think it's so helpful what you said about dopamine and serotonin. And I've often talked about this. I said to myself when I gave up the booze, I'm going to heal my gut. I'm healing my gut, Gary, my husband. I think I've leaky gut, you know. And I was reading, all self-taught, no qualifications in this BTW. So I was like, I'll heal my old gut, right? So I've been on Simproof for years. I pay for it myself. And my thing about that is I don't drink. So I pay for Simproof, right? So Simproof, I think it healed my gut anyway. And then the dopamine thing, right? I talk about this all the time. So I'm all or nothing, right? I do stuff to excess. obviously, case in point. So, like, I'll go to the gym and, you know, I mightn't go for a while, but then I'll go for 2 hours every morning and get up at 5:30, you know, this kind of thing. And there's a specific point in the top of my lip where I'm pushing myself. My lip starts to quiver. I start to taste salt. And I know when that feeling comes upon me that I will sit in my car in unbelievable euphoria for 10 minutes after I get out of the gym. So there's ways to biohack your kind of neurochemicals, isn't there?
Completely, like especially with dopamine, and that is the main neurochemical that is involved with addiction, you know. And that's where, with more serious addictions, where choice is no longer a feature in whether you
Yes.
use it or not, your dopamine system has been hijacked. And I know what that feels like. It feels like you wake up in the morning, if you even go to bed, and you say, "Okay, that's it. I'm not going to do that today. I'm just not going to do it." But if your dopamine system has been hijacked, it will needle, bargain, push. Your whole nervous system thinks that it's about to be attacked by, I don't know, a serial killer, whatever. That is, so when people say, well, why can't they just stop consciously, which is only 5% of your mind, I've never met somebody in addiction that can't list out every single reason why they can't stop.
Yes.
They know, I knew, you know, I wasn't deluded about my addiction. But unless the subconscious mind, which is 95% of the mind, is on board, it's very hard to change a habit. It's very hard to recalibrate a dopamine system. But absolutely, Olivia, those things, I always say that to my clients. When I say to a client, exercise, I'm not just saying it as in, oh yeah, exercise, it's good for you, go for a walk, you know, that's really big. I explain to them, this is why your dopamine system is downregulated. That's, you know, in order to stop you feeling that grayness, it still takes time with dopamine, no matter what. But yes, for sure, going to the gym, pushing yourself, making yourself feel uncomfortable is what will upregulate dopamine faster, because the body will always seek to be balanced. So, like you described there, you pushed yourself for 2 hours, you would have felt a lot of discomfort as well along that way. So your dopamine would have felt, okay, this is kind of painful almost to a degree. But in order to seek balance again, it will overcompensate on the upside. So therefore, that's when you get that feel-good feeling, that euphoria, for sure. Breath work is another one that can get you into a state where you can feel euphoric. I use breath work an awful lot. I still do, but very much in my early recovery on this occasion, it was a game changer. The food that you eat, you know, there's a lot of talk, of course, about cold plunges. Again, it has that same concept. Do something that makes you uncomfortable, because you are going to gain that feel good, euphoric feeling a lot easier. That's the way dopamine works. So yeah, like I would ask myself that question a lot. Like, what is, if something in life is too easy, if feeling okay and normal and not facing up to your feelings, if you start using quick fix solutions, artificial solutions to that, that's quick fix and dopamine. You'll pay a price. That's just the way that it is. You pay the price. Whereby, if you search for that dopamine with effort, the 2 hours in the gym, the 1 hour walk, the turn your
Cold
shower,
plunge.
to switch it to the cold side of it, whatever, for 1 minute. This is how you upregulate your dopamine naturally. There's effort involved. But I guess we live in a world now as well where, I think somebody wrote a book about it actually, called A Comfort Crisis, where, like, do whatever you can, but do not feel uncomfortable. And it's kind of like, it's probably why people are addicted to a lot of stuff now. Like, it's not just alcohol, substances, it's behaviors, it's scrolling, it's porn, it's, you know, it's so many things, gambling. But I think to have acceptance in the fact that if you are very serious about becoming a non-drinker, be prepared to feel a little bit uncomfortable. But don't mistake that feeling of discomfort as this isn't working, or a feeling, it actually shows your brain is working. Your brain has recognized, oh my God, this pattern has changed. What's going on here? Is this, you know, is this person in trouble? And it may sound sometimes like the subconscious mind is out to out
Gotcha.
to on your life, and it's not, but it's primitive. It's
Yes.
not as evolved as the conscious mind. It's a much
Yeah.
more primitive. Its main job is to keep you alive. And if you are somebody that for a long time has used alcohol in order to deal with pain, to deal with emotions, your subconscious, it's a pattern. It's that's neuroplasticity. You have made this pathway, which is a well-trodden pathway. Subconscious likes the easy way. If the alcohol is giving, it's become the solution to not wanting to think the way that you do. Well, then when you try to change that, the subconscious mind is going to make you feel uncomfortable because it doesn't like that. But that's when you have to go through the discomfort. I think some philosopher, I don't know who, said the only way out is through.
Yeah.
You go through it and you start building evidence that you are now a person that can do difficult things, that you can deal with your emotions in a healthier way. Go for a run instead. You know, you meditate, you dance, you sing a song, whatever it may be. I mean, I've done some mad things in my early recovery. I think sometimes I should have recorded myself because it definitely would have been, if someone was looking in, would have said that person needs to be, you know, signed in somewhere. But yeah, I was desperate, and the gift of desperation, I suppose. I mean, I used meditation predominantly for my, this time around, after trying everything else. I knew I needed to change the way my subconscious mind thought about me, thought about the world. And also the lies that your subconscious mind will lie to you. Don't believe your mind when you are reliant on a substance, because it will tell you that your life is, it will tell you that your life is more fun with alcohol and drugs and that you'll be boring without it. It will tell you that you need it because you're very stressed. It will justify to the nth degree. Like, your subconscious doesn't care about the consequences. Not because it doesn't care, it just cares about keeping you alive. It just goes with the familiar pattern. Whatever is familiar, it will go with, despite it only knows that in that moment you are uncomfortable. So therefore, what normally works is a drink. Have that drink.
Yeah.
So that is a case of having to rewire that pattern. You know, and that's what I did. I switched it around. I just had to keep dismantling the beliefs that I needed alcohol and drugs to be able to exist in the world. And that's, I think, why I'm still sober, because my subconscious mind doesn't try so much anymore because it knows the jig is up now. But, you know, it can sometimes come up with maybe you should have a drink. But I don't believe any of the lies that it will
do. That's the thing.
I don't believe it will do. I don't believe it will be. This was a big one for me, just for one night only.
Exactly. And as you know, it can be a gateway. You know what? Just as we finish up there, because I'd say we could easily talk for a lot longer, because I don't think we've even scratched the surface there for a lot of things. But let's say you were saying about the lies you tell yourself. A book I am I'm reading in the background, not consistently, but it's Tell Yourself Better Lies by Marissa Peer, right? And tell me this, what resources would you give to people, or would you tell to read or whatever, to begin to understand their unconscious mind and to maybe stop believing their own lies or what their brain is telling them?
Well, actually, you mentioned Marissa Peer there. I trained under Marissa Peer, so it's her type of hypnotherapy that I'm trained in.
Okay.
So that would be a very good book. I suppose with regards to the subconscious mind, anything by Carl Jung. I think Carl, you know, you don't even need to buy a book or just even Google stuff online on YouTube. I mean, Carl Jung and his the way he talks about addiction, and I read a lot of his work in my early recovery. It made a lot of sense to me.
That mad? Because I literally listened to a podcast yesterday by James Hollis. Have you heard of him?
No.
So he interprets the work of Carl Jung and to make it maybe a little bit more palatable or understandable for the normies like us out there. But it was incredible. I'll share that in the show notes. That's by Elise Lunan from Pulling the Thread. It was incredible.
Well, I mean, that's one of his most famous quotes is, until you make the subconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. And it's very true. How many people arrive on their deathbed? And I think it actually, that woman, that Bronnie Ware, the palliative therapist who wrote a book about it, one of the main regrets was, I just wish I'd lived the life that I wanted to live. No person in addiction will arrive on their deathbed and ever regret that they, you know, or I wish I didn't stop drinking, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And I think that's so, with regards to Carl Jung, is like, until you understand what's on, you know, beneath, what's leading thoughts, what's leading behaviors, well, then are you really living the life that you want to live? And that can, that applies to people who don't even have an issue with substance addiction. You know, that can be for anyone. So I would say, yes, look, there is so much out there now that people can do. The main thing I'd say is, yeah, look, ask for help. It's hard to do it on your own. It really, really is. Have faith. I think that is also so important. And I really would say this. I mean, it really looked like it was not going to happen that I was going to get sober. I mean, I really mean that. And I do think, like, if it's possible for anyone, why is, sometimes people can think, oh, well, that's, you're different or whatever. No, millions of people get sober. If they can do it, you can do it. Don't allow your brain to tell you that, no, that's for them, not me. That will work for them. I'm not like that. Everybody has it in them. And it just takes those first, just take that step. Don't let fear hold you back. There is nothing to fear. Don't think about the future. Don't think about, oh, I can't get sober because, oh my God, then I'm going to have to feel. You'll be okay. It will not kill you. It will be uncomfortable. But it's, as I said, if you use your mind in the right way, sobriety is so much easier than you think. It really is. Even go at it with that mindset. You know, that's what I have to keep saying to myself. You know, I am, I have fear, but I have more courage than fear. You know, even I would say I would get into a, you know, into a theta brainwave state through meditation, through breath work, and keep saying that to myself over and over again. That is how I got sober. I had to go to that level. So yeah, I would say, please don't give up hope. And absolutely, if you can educate yourself as to how the mind works, do that. You know, go online. That's how I started with all of this. That first day, I felt, okay, if I'm to get sober, how am I going to get sober? Because my brain, there's something wrong with it. I really believe that. I believe that. I always had that belief that, you know, who you are, your personality is formed by the age of, you know, 25. And that day I actually Googled, that was when I started the path to sobriety on this occasion, can I fix my brain? And that's when I discovered neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to change. And that just gave me so much hope. So absolutely, get curious.
Exactly. And you know that saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Yeah, you can. You can teach old humans absolutely anything.
Absolutely. Everybody is capable of things. And, you know, and as I said, like, don't believe that the way you feel now about getting sober is the way that you're going to feel in even 5 days' time, a week's time. Take baby steps. Do one thing every day to support the path that you're on. And believe in yourself and just, be patient.
Angela, oh my God, I have adored our conversation. I really have. Thank you. And I'm super impressed. You have such an incredible knowledge base. You have an incredible story. It's the truest story of resilience and bounce back ability and, you know, hope, resilience, you know, the ability for our ability to change. And, you know, when you were talking there, about like being brave and stuff. I watch Bluey with my kids every night. We do a little episode and it's, oh my God, like if we could all just live our lives like Bluey, her sister and her mom and dad, I think the world would be a better place. But anyway, Bluey does something that she's afraid of. And the dad says, well, it's a good thing you're brave. And like, let that become your mantra. Like it's a, I know, you know, not drinking at this wedding or, you know, at this Mayo homecoming is hard, but it's a good thing I'm brave. Angela, where can people find you if they want to work with you, chat to you, you know, get a bit of Angela crack going?
Yeah, I'm just thinking of what's my website. Hold on. Oh, yeah. www.flowstate. Yes. As in a flow state, flowstatecoaching.ie, and then I'm on Instagram.
Yes, you are. I put it all in the show notes.
Yeah, still not, the social media side of things is not something I'm good at. Olivia, thank you so much for having me on, and you know, so lovely to connect with you.
Amazing. Thanks, Angela.
Thanks, Olivia. Bye now.
Bye. No More Booze, the podcast, is produced, mixed and mastered at the studios of Irish Audio Drama. For more information, visit irishaudiodrama.com.